Hello. We'll start with 422. So if anybody didn't ask, Gary's not here for me to pick on. But he signed, you know, on cruises and stuff, you can sign up for stuff. He signed up for full contact pickleball and did not understand what he was signing up for. That's what happened to him. So 422. Part of that is actually true. Yeah, the pickleball part. So let's start with 422. Count me. Stand with me, please. Let's sing all four verses, the refrain on 1 and 4. 422, all four verses, refrain 1 and 4. Sorry, Angela. Here we go. Count me. Seated and turn to 408, close to thee, 408, and let's sing all three verses, 408.
Close to thee.
23. Something for these. This is our offering in this evening. Stand with me, and we'll sing all three verses of 4:23.
Thank you, Tobias. Did you get a copy of the outline? If you didn't and need one, wave your hand there, and Brother Spital will get you one. Get one to you if anybody needs one. We are in Job. We are finally done listening to his friends. Including Elihu, who proved not to be, I believe he proves not to be much of a friend of anybody. Job's three friends and peers have argued strenuously that for God to have sent such overwhelming calamity into Job's life, Job must have sinned and sinned grievously. They have no evidence of any particular sin. They have no witnesses to accuse him of anything specific, yet they brought all sorts of charges against him. They've assumed all sorts of things, and they've urged him to confess his sin and to repent. Job has steadfastly maintained his innocence, or at least his ignorance. He's asked God to show him his sin so he can confess. Can't confess to anything he's not aware of, he says. And he's asked God to explain. He doesn't believe he's done anything to provoke the kind of punishment he seems to be receiving. And in his despair, he has called on God to come and present his case against him and allow Job to present a defense. So look, I'm on trial here. God, why don't you just show up so I can defend myself? Well, he's going to get his wish. Now, Job, see, didn't know what God was doing. He's made that clear. And he's called into question whether God knows what he's doing. All right? That seems to be some of what he's asking. And as far as Job can tell, he's getting to the point where it seems like either God's not in control or he just doesn't care what happens to Job. And to be really honest with ourselves, we'd have to admit we can kind of sympathize. That life can take a turn that can leave us with questions like that. And that's where Job seems to be. Job doesn't yet understand that the opposite is actually the case. As one writer put it, God is honoring Job by putting his full confidence in the genuineness of Job's faith, which Satan questioned, end quote. And Job just isn't yet aware of that. Well, at this point in the narrative, as we come into chapter 38, God grants Job's request. He shows up for the trial. But his response isn't what Job expected. God's confrontation of Job is expressed in two parts. Job is given a chance to speak briefly between the two, and really after each, again at the end of the second. And it's the first of those sections we're going to look at this evening. What's kind of surprising is that God hasn't come to explain. As we will see, God doesn't explain anything. All right? Those who say, well, Job's all about, you know, I mentioned this at the beginning, that Job's, if we think of Job as dealing with the issue of why the righteous suffer, it doesn't really provide an answer for that question. Job is now going to be confronted by God, and instead of answering Job's questions, God really didn't answer any of them, not directly at least. He presents Job with a barrage of questions of his own. And in tonight's text alone, these two chapters, I counted 53 questions from God to Job. Now, for the sake of brevity in the outline, I didn't list all 53 questions. I've put subpoints in quotation marks. They're actually paraphrases, kind of summarizing some of the questions that God asks Job, and we'll read the text in little bits as we go. Let's ask the Lord's blessing on our study this evening. Father, as we come tonight together to study this portion of your word, I pray, Lord, that our hearts will be ready to receive, to be challenged by what you said to Job all those centuries or millennia ago. And Lord, the things that it reveals about who you are and the limits of our own knowledge in many cases remain still true about our own limitations, Lord. And I pray that we will be humbled before you as Job was as we study your word tonight, and that we might marvel in your magnificent glory. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, God begins his presentation with this two-chapter diatribe, series of questions thrown at Job. That I believe demonstrates God's sovereign power displayed in the cosmos. That's how I phrased it for the first chapter. God's sovereign power displayed in the cosmos, or in the universe. It's as if God has accepted Job's challenge to come to court and present his indictment in a kind of an ironic quasi-equality with Job. As if, okay, Job, all right, we'll do this kind of face-to-face, man-to-man, as it were, even though you're a man, I'm not, right? He shows up to kind of do what Job asked in this indictment, but it's not going to look particularly equal in this, since when God descended upon those who were assembled there, he came in a whirlwind. Right, read that as tornado. Now, I've never witnessed a tornado close up where I could see it coming, but I've seen videos of them, and it's overwhelming, right? Imagine as they're sitting there in the plane there, wherever they happen to be, and they're, I don't know if they're just sitting in the dirt or if there's a formal kind of probably an outdoor setting for this. But all of a sudden, if you've been in a situation where you've got a tornado warning out or a tornado watch, you know, the sky can get really weird looking. It gets dark and it's windy and thunder often with a thunderstorm associated. And then all of a sudden the funnel comes down and it's right there and a voice comes out of this tornado, all right? And it's God speaking. That's the setting, and it's almost impossible to even imagine sitting there and absorbing whatever God is saying in this kind of a setting. It's not like when the Lord came to Abraham and sat down outside his tent and shared bread with them, like I mentioned this morning. It's not like that at all. A tornado came roaring up and stopped in front of them and spoke to him from the tornado. And I mentioned last time that his first words from this tornado, who is this, verse 2 of chapter 38, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? And I said last time that I really don't think that God is saying that to Job. I think, he is addressing Job, but he's referring to Elihu, who has just spent four chapters claiming to speak for God and saying things God never said, and claiming to know things and claiming to be perfect in knowledge as if God had inspired him to say these things, when in fact that had not been the case. And so basically God is just kind of flicking him out of the way, right? That doesn't say anything about him getting sucked up in the whirlwind. I don't think that's what happened, but we never see or hear from Elihu again. And I think that's what he's dismissing him, saying, look, Job, don't even bother answering this guy. He's speaking words without knowledge, and he's darkening counsel with words without knowledge. That's something God never accuses Job of. In fact, says otherwise about Job in chapter 42. Then he tells him to gird up your loins as a man. Basically, he means prepare for the debate that you demanded. All right, how I phrase it for letter A. Prepare for the debate you demanded. Okay, you wanted this confrontation. Make sure you're ready. Gird up your loins like a man. It's a military expression about preparing for hand-to-hand combat, whether it's with weapons like a sword or grappling, wrestling, either one. Gird up your loins like a man and get ready for this. Now, I think we probably do God and Job a disservice. I'm going to try not to give in to the temptation to read this with a harshly sardonic tone from God. Because I don't think that's what's going on. I think God is sympathetic with Job's plight. He's aware of what's happening. He knows Job doesn't know what's happening. And so I'm inclined to think that while there's a lot of irony in the questions God asks Job, that I think it's probably more gentle than harsh. I think it's as if he is coming to Job and saying, look, Job, I know you're frustrated. I know you're confused. And I'm not going to explain. You're not even going to like what I have to say. But I am going to point out to you some things that you really need to consider. And so I think that that's more the tone that God is taking with him. And I'll try not to give in to the temptation to read it more harshly than that. But then he asks the first ironic question in verse 4. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Now, I phrase this for brevity's sake, and so we can get it all in one line. Where were you when I created the earth? Although I really think that's probably a poor paraphrase. Because to lay the foundations of the earth is probably more involved than creating the earth. I'm not sure that the laying of the foundations of the earth is what God did on day one of creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Because Job has already said that God has hanged the earth or suspended the earth upon nothing. If you were asked to describe the foundations of the earth, upon what is the earth itself founded? Probably the best answer, I'm not a physicist, I don't pretend to be a physicist. I'm interested in physics, but I'm not a physicist. But probably, to me, it would seem the most reasonable answer would be that it's founded upon gravitational forces, as it's suspended upon nothing, all right? You've got, Job has already acknowledged that, and the foundations of the earth probably includes the establishing of the cosmos, at least our own solar system, as something that holds the earth in place. Possibly the entire universe would be included in that. And the point God's making here is not only does Job have no real understanding of what the foundations of the earth might entail, when he asks, you know, where were you when I did this, is the fact that, you know, anything Job might build, any of the homes his sons built for their families, is laid upon a foundation God made that is established upon a foundation of nothing we understand. Okay? And that's a pretty big point to make right off the bat. This world is founded upon nothing you can see, and you would only barely be capable of understanding it. And that's just question number one. Where were you when I created the earth, or founded the earth, if you will? The next question asks about the earth's measurements. It might simply imply that Job had no way of having measured the earth's circumference. Verses 5, 6, and 7. Who set its measurements, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? And who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? I phrased this, trying to think of a way to summarize this. I stated it in the outline simply as who designed its architecture. But I think even that's, again, everything I try to say in just a few words comes short. But who designed the earth's architecture? It has more to do than just with the dimensions, the size of it. It has to do with overall construction, the minute details of its structure. You know, much of the physics involved in the Earth's structure, the various layers of the Earth, you know, the core, the mantle, the crust, and so on, remain really beyond the human ability to prove today. They've theorized about some things. They've got pretty good ideas of several things, but it's still beyond our ability to explain, and certainly beyond our ability to reproduce. When he speaks of the morning stars singing together and the sons of God shouting for joy. Those expressions, morning stars and sons of God, throughout the Old Testament refer to angelic hosts, the angelic beings. It is usually assumed from this question, the way God asked this question, that the angelic beings must have been created before the earth and were observers when God created the earth in Genesis 1:1. I don't think the wording here requires that. If God's founding of the earth, his laying the foundations of the earth and establishing it upon nothing is in fact involves the creation of the cosmos, the sun, moon, and stars, you understand those weren't created until day four. And so the angels could have been created, since the scriptures say repeatedly that everything in the heavens and the earth, God made the heavens and the earth and everything in them in 6 days, if they were created during the 6 days of creation, as I believe that statement requires, then they could have been created any time, day one, two, three, or four. I suspect day four, as a part of the heavenly hosts when God made the sun, moon, and stars, and the morning stars and the sons of God were rejoicing as they saw the conclusion of the establishing of the cosmos, which would have been on day four of creation. So I don't think this passage requires that the angelic beings were created before day one, as many have concluded from this. I don't think we should draw that from this. Then in verses 8 through 11, and again, I don't have time to, I got to be careful. I'll spend too long on any one verse or two. Verses 8 through 11, he adds, "Or who enclosed the sea with doors, when bursting forth it went out from the womb? When I made a cloud its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and I placed boundaries on it and set a bolt and doors, and I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther. And here shall your proud waves stop." So as I phrase it here, who controls the boundaries of the seas? Although there's a lot in the phrasing here that is reminiscent of the flood, the idea of bursting forth as from the womb, I think, has to do with the breaking up of the fountains of the deep at the time of the flood, when the earth was inundated, and then God reshaped the surface of the earth, changing its topography so that the seabeds were deeper, the mountains were higher, so that it could contain on the surface more water than it used to have on the surface. And then God bolted the door to limit what the sea could cover. So it has to do mostly with topographical matters, ocean depths, coastlines, island and inland elevations. It also has to do with the impact of weather, tidal forces exerted by the earth's rotation and the moon's revolution around the earth. And God says to Job, okay, who's in charge of all that? Don't think it was you. Now, so far, God has asked questions all have to do with three-dimensional space. Next question brings up the fourth dimension, time. Have you ever in your life commanded the morning? I mean, your rooster thinks that's his job, but that's because he's dumb. He's a rooster. But the sun really doesn't come up because the rooster crows. It doesn't come up because you call it forth either. And now some of the imagery in the next few verses is poetic, but it describes God as if he's taken hold of the poles of the earth to spin it for the coming of morning, turning it like clay being rolled upon a seal to leave an impression. Evidently, like the impression made and baked in during the sun during the day. Let me read the verses 12 to 15. Have you ever in your life commanded the morning and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal, and they stand forth like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and the uplifted arm is broken. Now, see, because of the references to light exposing evil works of darkness, It may make reference also to judgment as being part of God's responsibility and not yours, Job. Did you create days and establish time? I think is included in this question. It's what this question embraces, letter E. Did you create days and establish time? Which, of course, was no human invention at all. We can mark time, we cannot make it. Okay? We can mark time, but we cannot make it. We are trapped within it. Verse 16, have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Job, just how well do you know the ocean floor? Okay? Not very, God, you know, if you really demand an answer. Have you explored, as I phrased it here in my notes, have you explored the ocean floor? Verse 17, have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? I think that's a question. Do you understand death? Not just the fact of death, but what lies beyond the gates of death? Have you, Job, been there and returned so that you can describe it? Verse 18 asks, I think, what we might have thought verse 5 asked. Have you understood the expanse of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. And so I phrased it, can you perceive the dimensions of the earth? Because I think it encompasses that. Do you know just how far you'd have to walk to circumnavigate the world? Have you perceived its dimensions? But its expanse may actually be a lot broader than that. The expanse of the earth may not just have to do with the dimensions of the celestial body itself. It may have to do with the path it traverses as it rotates or revolves around the sun, right? What about the path the earth travels as it circles the sun? Do you understand that expanse? That's a lot bigger expanse, because that's a path that takes it a whole year to cover, right? As it circles the sun at a distance of about 93 million miles as a radius, if you will. It may also even have be a question of relative size within the cosmos. You know, the Earth's size within the cosmos is on a cosmic scale, the Earth is a little tiny speck, and we are the Who's down in Whoville, okay? You know, if you're familiar with that Dr. Seuss story. But if you also add in the atomic scale in that span, then you'll find that mankind is roughly in the middle of that scale. Job, how well do you understand that? It's kind of mind-boggling to consider even with what we do know. It's kind of still difficult to kind of wrap our minds around the concepts of space. If that's what God means, he's not simply asking if Job knows this, but do you understand its significance? Then in the next couple of verses, verses 19 to 21, now he's going to talk about light. Where is the way to the dwelling of light, and darkness, where is its place, that you may take it to its territory, that you may discern the paths to its home? You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. Okay. If you're that old, tell me. Where do light and darkness originate, is how I phrase this question for letter I. Where do light and darkness originate? Ask about its dwelling, asks about its paths. You know, by asking those questions, God implies that light moves, and that's not something that is easily perceivable by our senses. It moves so quickly, we don't necessarily recognize light moving, as it were, just kind of is. And he's asking Job if he... It's possible God is asking Job if he understands the dimensions of the universe. You know, astronomical distances are generally measured in terms of light and its and how far it travels. A light year is not a marking of time, it's a marking of distance. It's how far light can travel in a year. And it can travel a long way in a year. Light travels 186,000 miles a second. There are 31,557,600 seconds in a year. One light year is a distance just under 5.9 trillion miles. That's a long way. Now, let me, to help us get, you know, that's a number that's hard to conceive, and so I'm trying to figure out how can I even get my mind around that number. If I convert it to money, convert 5.9 trillion to dollars, imagine you've got a machine that prints $50 bills, one $50 bill a second, right? That's $180,000 an hour. That's $4,320,000 every day that that machine prints. $50 bills at one a second, $4.32 million every day. If that machine started printing those $50 bills every second at the moment that Jesus was born, it would finish printing $5.9 trillion 1,720 years from now. Okay. If you want it to have finished printing $5.9 trillion by now at $50 a second, it had to start printing them about the time Joseph died in Egypt. And that's just one light year in distance, okay? It's a long way. The nearest star to our sun is Proxima Centauri, and it's approximately 4 light years from here. That's the nearest star. It's approximately 4 light years away. It is estimated that the Milky Way galaxy in which our system is located, that the Milky Way galaxy itself is 100,000 light years across and about 1,000 light years thick. And there are billions of galaxies beyond the Milky Way. And so when he asks Job, do you know where light originates? And can you trace it back to its home? That's a really big question, all by itself. Now, to come back to a subject maybe that's a little more mundane, and again, that helps date this book much earlier than it's usually thought to date, because it's another reference to frozen precipitation in verses 22 and 23. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of distress and for the day of war and battle? Now, storehouses might have to do with the polar ice caps, which were much more extensive then than they are now. Might have to do with the atmospheric formation of snow and hail. It might have to do with the microscopic structural details of snow and hail. I don't know. It could have to do with all of those things. The fact he mentions them being reserved for the time of distress, for the day of war and battle, I think is a really interesting statement of anticipation of God's use of hail as a plague in Egypt, and then a little later to assist Joshua's army in the defense of the Gibeonites against their Amorite neighbors in Joshua chapter 10, when he sent a hailstorm that big enough hailstones falling on the Amorite army that it was killing everybody it struck, but precise enough that it was chasing them while Joshua and his army were chasing them, and it killed all the Amorites, and none of Joshua's army got hit. All right. So God says it's reserved for the time of war also. That may be just kind of an anticipation of that. Now in the next verse, the next section, the reference to the way that light is divided in verse 24. Where is the way that the light is divided, or the east wind scattered on the earth? Most interpreters take that to, and I've treated it the way most interpreters have, as if it's a reference to, because of the connection to the east wind, as a connection to lightning. And the question being, can you control the lightning or the wind? However, the dividing of the light may actually be the movement of the illuminated circle around the globe as the earth rotates on its axis. And that may have to do more with the question of understanding the earth's rotation on its axis. The point of the question, though, is basically, Job, you can't explain how any of this stuff works. Let alone can you control it to do your bidding. Just have to acknowledge that. Verses 25 to 28 has to do with rain and thunder. Who controls the rain and thunder? Who has cleft a channel for the flood or a way for the thunderbolt to bring rain on a land without people, on desert without a man in it, to satisfy the waste and desolate land and to make the seeds of grass to sprout? Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? The point God's making with part of this is, you know, the rain falls on uninhabited land too, and the desert land. Job, you got to understand, God is watering the whole earth, even places where nobody lives. And you can't make it rain on your own crops. That's an important point that Job needs to remember. And then with another reference to the colder climate, from whose womb has come the ice and the frost of heaven? Who has given it birth? Water becomes hard like stone, and the surface of the deep is imprisoned. That's an interesting statement. When was the last time anybody living in Palestine saw the ocean freeze, the surface of the deep freeze over and imprison it? That sounds like an Arctic region. The climate had to be much, much colder than. The deep implies, you know, a much larger body of water than a pond or the Sea of Galilee or even the Dead Sea for it to be considered the deep. Next verse is, now you got to look up, look beyond the earth. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth a constellation in its season and guide the bear with her satellites? The word translated constellation is Mazaroth. It has to do with making of distinctions. It might be he's referring to the 12 signs of the zodiac, the constellations, as it's translated here, or he may be asking, Job, can you distinguish each star one from another? Size, magnitude, color, can you distinguish them from others? That's a much tougher question than discerning the shapes of the stars in their constellations. It's possible that Job has witnessed God. We've already mentioned this, that Job has witnessed God stretching out the heavens and reshaping the sky, as it were, so that the stars took on a different shape and constellations, and he may have witnessed that probably during the days of Peleg when the earth was divided, and we've talked about that already. I'm not going to go back over all of that. But at the very least, God is telling Job, you can't do that. You can't reach up into the heavens and rearrange the stars and create new constellations of your own. You have a hard time picking them out with your naked eye, let alone making them happen. At the very least, that's what he means. You can't move them across the sky seasonally. That's something that happens without your input, Job. So the way I phrased it, can you change the configuration of the stars or cause their seasonal movement? Job, that's really not up to you. The next question, verse 33, may be especially about the laws of gravitation and planetary motion. Do you know the ordinances of the heavens or fix their rule over the earth? Might include quantifying atmospheric movement and turbulence. Has a lot of broad implications. I paraphrase it simply. Can you understand or comprehend the laws of nature? The ordinances of the heavens fix their rule over the earth. Can you reduce to mathematic equations so that you can understand and communicate to others how the universe works? There's one not so trivial fact about the contrary forces that are at work. You've got the explosive energy that drives things apart that's in tension with the gravitational force that's pulling things together. And the balance point that they have to strike for the universe to exist. Quantum physicist John Polkinghorne makes this point. He makes about just how he makes an analogy on how fine a point of balance it takes for those two forces to work together in the universe to function. When he compares it to, he says it's comparable to hitting a target 1 inch wide from a distance of 20 million light years. You understand that's 200 times farther than the width of the Milky Way galaxy, as I was just giving you some of those numbers. Job, can you comprehend just how finely tuned the universe has to be to function? The laws of nature. Next question is a little more specifically about the weather. Verses 34 and 35, can you lift up your voice to the clouds so that an abundance of water will cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Is the weather subject to your command, Job? I mean, we have a hard time forecasting it, let alone causing it, right? Any forecast that looks more than about 3 days out is highly suspect. They're getting pretty good at it. You can get a pretty good idea two, three days out. They're trying now to go about 10 days, but even that's highly suspect. God doesn't say it, but everybody, when God asks the question here about the weather, he doesn't say this, but everybody would think, you know, no, actually, when we need rain, we can't command it to fall. We have to appeal to you, but I guess that's your point, isn't it? You know, that's what God's getting at. Job, you and your friends think you're smart, and you aren't wrong. In verse 36, he he makes this point. But why do you think that is? Verse 36. Who put wisdom in the innermost being or has given understanding to the mind? I mean, what do you think is the source of your intellect, Job? And I got to tell you, way too few people today ever bother to ask that question of themselves. We think ourselves quite intelligent. The agnostic who says, well, I just haven't been convinced because I think I'm too smart to fall for that stuff, hasn't ever grappled with the question is, why do you think you're smart? Who gave you intellect? Who put wisdom in the innermost being? Who gives wisdom and understanding? I phrase it from under Q. Who gives wisdom and understanding? Now, before shifting gears, he's about to shift gears, but he reinforces all this with a question in verses 37 to 38. Who can count the clouds by wisdom or tip the water jars of the heavens when the dust hardens into a mass and the clods stick together? Essentially, what God's asking here is he's just summarizing what he said in these other questions. Who possesses the wisdom to rule creation? Well, clearly, Job, not you. Not your friends. Who possesses the wisdom to rule creation? Then with the last three verses of the chapter and moving on to the next chapter, God reminds Job and other and the observers that they also need to recognize God's sovereign power displayed in the animals. Now he shifts from describing astronomical things and geological and to things that are biological. The animal kingdom. And kind of like, okay, Job, just in case you aren't feeling overwhelmed yet, well, let's talk about the animals now. Now, I confess, you're looking at the clock thinking, oh, man, it's already getting late and we've got a whole other chapter to do. I will tell you right now, I find zoology a lot less fascinating than I find physics or astronomy, personally. Okay, it's just me. So I'm going to take a lot less time with this section than I did with the other because what we've just been going over is something that I find more fascinating than this subject. Verses 39 and 40, can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens and lie in wait in their lair? Do you provide for the lion, Job? Do they rely on you for their care? I mean, do you have to make sure you get food to them or they're going to starve? Verse 41, what about the raven? Who provides for the raven? Who prepares for the raven its nourishment when its young cry to God and wander about without food? Job, you may know a lot about your camels, and you may know a lot about your donkeys and your sheep and your oxen, but do you know when mountain goats give birth? Look at the next chapter, verse 1. Do you know the time the mountain goats give birth? And in the second half of the verse, what about the deer? Do you observe the calving of the deer? Can you count the months they fulfill? Do you know the time they give birth? They kneel down, they bring forth their young, they get rid of their labor pains, their offspring becomes strong, they grow up in the open field, they leave and do not return to them. All right, the parents of the young, they reproduce, they give birth without checking with you. They don't have to come to you for their care. They take care of themselves in the birthing process, and then their young need the parental care only briefly because they soon become independent and run off on their own and they never have a relationship with their parents again. Job, understand, that's not something you did for them. Verses 5 through 8, who freed the wild donkey? Who sent out the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the swift donkey to whom I gave the wilderness for a home and the salt land for his dwelling place? He scorns the tumult of the city. The shoutings of the driver he does not hear. He explores the mountains for his pasture and searches after every green thing. Yeah, the sound of the driver he doesn't hear, right? That donkey, he's not listening to you. Yeah, that wild donkey, he's set free by... I'm the one who set him free. He has the run of the wilderness. He spurns civilization, ignores all attempts to command him. Now, in verses 9 and 10, the King James uses the word unicorn. And that's caused a lot of people to insist that unicorns are not mythical because The Bible talks about unicorns. It's unclear exactly what animal this might be. The word does refer, the word does emphasize a conspicuous horn. So it may be an animal with a single horn, or at least a dominant horn. It could be a rhinoceros. It could be something now extinct. The wild aurochs is often put forward as what it might be referring to. But there's really no support at all for picturing this as a horse with a horn in the center of its forehead. All right, that is the mythical unicorn that is popular in our own pop culture today. In the outline, I'm tempted to just fill in rhinoceros, but feel free to use the word adopted by most modern translators. Can you control the wild ox? But it has to do with a prominent horn. A wild ox doesn't generally have just one horn or a prominent one, although the aurochs does. But the aurochs is often thought to have been mythological too, but there is pretty good evidence that they really existed. Whatever the animal is, God is making his case for something I've mentioned before. The point is that some animals are domestic because God made them to serve man, not because mankind managed to domesticate them. And so these animals that are wild because that's the way I made them, and Job, there's nothing you can do about it. But I don't think we should go to the King James to try to prove that unicorns existed on the strength of this word. Now, the next verse includes a word used only here in the Hebrew text. The King James translates it as peacock. They're guessing, and they admit they were guessing in the preface. But more recent discoveries imply a larger bird, a flightless bird, so it's probably an ostrich. The word the King James renders ostrich in the next line actually means feathers. Verse 9, will the wild ox consent to serve you? Will he spend the night at your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in a furrow with ropes, or will he harrow the valleys after you? Will you trust him because his strength is great and leave your labor to him? Will you have faith in him that he will return to your grain and gather it from your threshing floor? That refers to the previous one that I hadn't read. Verse 13, the ostrich's wings flap joyously with the pinion and plumage of love. For she abandons her eggs to the earth, warms them in the dust, and she forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may trample them. She treats her young cruelly as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, she is unconcerned because God has made her forget wisdom and has not given her a share of understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she laughs at the horse and his rider. An ostrich can't outrun a horse. Basically, I think this passage asks, do you maintain the ostrich? And I use the word maintain here because God indicates the ostrich, as he describes it, the ostrich is careless parenting and general stupidity. They lay their eggs. They don't really tend them. If they're going to hatch, they're hatch. They may get crushed. And they're generally just careless and stupid. The point God seems to be making to Job is, Job, without my care, they'd be extinct. Okay, because they're too dumb to care for themselves and to maintain themselves. But you're not doing anything about it either. They're not counting on you for this. Now a domestic animal, verses 19 to 25. Did you give the horse his might? Did you clothe his neck with a mane? Did you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrible. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed. He does not turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the flashing spear and javelin. With shaking and rage, he races over the ground, and he does not stand still at the voice of the trumpet. As often as the trumpet sounds, he says, "Aha!" And he scents the battle from afar, and the thunder of the captains and the war cry. Well, Job, you didn't domesticate the horse either. Did you give the horse his strength and courage? What's emphasized here, his strength and courage? A very strong case can be made that other than perhaps some animals that have been used for food, the horse has been more useful to humanity than any other animal in creation throughout history. And mankind can't take credit for that. Now, a horse generally has to be broken, is the word they would use, to train it to a saddle. But it generally is a good horse will stand still in battle for you, and he'll charge into the weapons that are brought up against you, and is very useful for war, courageous and strong, and loyal, and those are characteristics God gave the horse. You didn't, is the point that God is making to Job here. In verse 26, he asks, "Did you instruct the hawk? Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars, stretching his wings toward the south?" I mean, did you teach the hawk to hunt? Did you give it acute eyesight to see its prey and the ability to dive down on its prey so quickly? Did you teach it to fly south for the winter? And likewise, did you command the eagle? Verses 27 to 30, is it your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the cliff he dwells and lodges upon the rocky crag, an inaccessible place. From there he spies out food. His eyes see it from afar. His young ones also suck up blood, and where the slain are, there is he. Do you command the eagle? The eagle's eyesight is legendary. We even use it just as a cliche, a person being eagle-eyed. But the eagle isn't the predator that the hawk is. The eagle's more of a scavenger, helpful to man by disposing of decaying flesh and dead animals. Drinking up blood, where the slain are, there he is a reference to the eagle being a scavenger, a carrion animal. The point God is making here is that the animals don't have to be trained by man in order to survive. God gave them instinctive knowledge so they can survive on their own, but he supervises and cares for them as well. He provides for them what they need without your input necessarily, Job. Now, after this diatribe, God has one more question. At the beginning of chapter 40, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Then the Lord said to Job, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it. And so we see God's sovereign power displayed in confronting Job, thirdly. His sovereign power displayed in confronting Job. Basically, what he's saying here is, Job, okay, I've responded to you. Now it's your turn to respond to me. This is your opportunity to respond to me. Job had demanded that God come and speak. God showed up in this whirlwind, this tornado. But he came not to give an explanation, but to give a cross-examination. And that's not what Job was counting on. It's not what he'd hoped for. God had replied with questions, not answers. To paraphrase what one writer said, Job has been throwing question after question after question at God because he could not explain of a sovereign, infinite, all-loving God why he was dealing with him in this manner. The intimation of Job's questioning was, I'm a rational human being. I only accept that which is comprehensible to me. God, I want you now to give a comprehensible answer for why I'm sitting in this ash pile when I've lived such an upright life before you. I've been good, but you've smitten me anyway. My theology is a shambles. Would you please explain what's going on in a way that makes sense? And then when God finally replied, rather than coming with a flurry of answers, he said, okay, I'm here. You stand up and answer me. And he hits Job with dozens of questions. Job wanted God to prove that the world was explainable. But that's not what God did. Christopher Morley, an early 20th century actor, sometimes wrote literary columns for the New York Evening Post. He once said this, "I went to the theater with the author of a successful play. He insisted on explaining everything. He told me what to watch, the details of direction, the errors of the property man, the foibles of the star. He anticipated all my surprises and ruined the evening. Never again. And mark you, the greatest author of all made no such mistake." End quote. And so rather than proving that the world was explainable, number two. It's what Job asked God to do. Rather than proving the world was explainable, he showed that the world was more mysterious than Job ever imagined. And when God did that, kind of like Christopher Morley said, Job, I think, says basically, you know what, come to think of it, there's a whole lot of stuff for which I don't have comprehensible answers that make my issues seem pretty insignificant, so I think I'll just keep quiet. And so in verses 3 through 5, Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once I have spoken, and I will not answer, even twice, and I will add nothing more." What I've said here for the outline, overwhelmed by the evidence, Job chose to remain silent. All I'll say is I got nothing to say. What's happened here is Job, his suffering was inexplicable apart from punishment for sin, and so Job thought that this adversity maligned his personal honor. He thought his adversity maligned his personal honor. That's what his friends were saying about him. It had provoked them to say these things about him. And so he thought he needed to be vindicated. That's what he's demanded from God. His friend's attitude had reinforced that opinion that God's treating you unfairly and it's just bringing a reproach upon your name. And so you need to be, your honor to be protected. And that's what he's asked God to come and do. He has now realized that his honor was insignificant in contrast with God's glory. What can I reply to you? I will not answer. His honor was not significant. What's significant is God's glory. God still has more to say, and we'll look at that next time. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for